This is PCJ Radio International.
Radio Berlin International.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Pyongyang of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
Well, hello, friends and listeners, and welcome to the monthly edition of Media Network Plus for the month of September. It's very nice to have you with me for the next hour. We have so many things to get to today that I'm going to keep my introduction brief. And that's only because, well, we have station features and some technical information about a test broadcast in DRM that we're going to be doing in the month of October. But first, let's get to our first station profile. Now, some of you are familiar with an area of Malaysia called Sarawak. It used to be known as Borneo. Now, there is a radio station that targets Sarawak in Malaysia every day. It's called Radio Free Sarawak. Now, this is a station that the Malaysian government has called the Naughty Station. Yes, I love that, actually. The Naughty Station. Yes, jolly good. Well, the station was started by Claire Rucastle, and she's our guest on the program right now.
Selamat bertemu baru Balapinga Mayuh, yaitu kita berumur yang ke siaran Radio Free Sarawak. Dipancar kami dengan gelombang angin pandai SW15420 kHz dari negeri.
This is an interesting station that you helped set up. Where did the idea come from, and was this something that you had been planning for a long time, even before you went on air?
It was, to begin with, a concept. You know, the way we are going to get this whole debate across to the communities of Sarawak, how are we going to do it? There's no point trying to produce a newspaper. There's no point trying to get this online. How are we going to reach these people? And the answer that kept coming up in my head and with anyone I ever talked to, well, we need, the only way to get through to people is by the radio. So the next step was, well, is it feasible? Is it possible? I have worked in radio before, but only in a very large organization. And you know, I had no concept of whether it would be possible. But I asked around, and if you want to do something, you usually end up managing to find a way. And we found a way, which was to use shortwave radio, which is now quite widely available.
Now, you said you are using shortwave radio. Did you also look at other delivery means, or did you know that, for example, if you had the program online, would the Malaysian government jam the website?
Well, online wasn't going to do the business for us. I mean, I already had an online blog, which had had an amazing and unexpectedly positive reception from the section of the public that was online, which is quite a big chunk of the Malaysian population. But these are only people who are living in the urban areas. And the people who've been worst affected by many of the issues that I'm concerned about, deforestation, oil palm, environmental destruction, human rights, indigenous rights, these people, of course, were far out in the jungle regions and had no access to online. So online radio, we do run our program online for those who are interested, but we're broadcasting actually in Iban to the interior communities. Shortwave came up as one way of reaching very distant communities from the other side of the world. Obviously, it's the medium to use. It's also cost effective. You know, I started this project with no promise of any money whatsoever. So I was looking for the cheapest option.
The content that you have, I'm really curious about, because I've spoken to people who've organized stations, let's say, that target North Korea, and they have people that work inside North Korea for them or under other very tense situations, and they always run into the problem that you have to sometimes hide the people that you're working with, and there's always the risk that they could get caught by the authorities. Is this the same situation for you? I mean, Malaysia, of course, is not North Korea, but you must be working under the same kind of difficulties.
Yes, we are. Although, to give Malaysia its due, I mean, I've got a lot of criticisms that I would make about Malaysia's human rights record, but they're not in the same category as North Korea, and they do want the rest of the world to think well of them. So we're not dealing with quite such an appalling regime. On the other hand, you are dealing with a regime that seeks by every means possible to intimidate and negatively affect anybody who is speaking out against Barisan Nasional, the ruling party. So people are very intimidated about, you know, their identities being known, because they think that could affect their lives and their families. And indeed, they could be arrested under a number of laws. There are sedition laws and so forth, emergency legislation that still exists that would enable them to be arrested and put in jail. We are under considerable constraints. Two of my members of staff have come out in the open, and we did that as a judgment call, actually. When Peter John, who was my very first DJ, came out into the open, we were here in London. We had the protection of being operating here in London, and we decided that it would really look too terrible if anything was done against him here. And when he subsequently went back to Kuching in Sarawak, it's really up to the government there whether they want to arrest our now part-time presenter and create an international incident over it, because, you know, I think they can be quite confident that I would scream from the rooftops if they moved against Peter or indeed any of my staff. So we've got a bit of a standoff, and, you know, so far we're muddling along, even though we've been told that we're completely illegal by the Malaysians.
Let's talk about the audience that you have. We've seen this happen in other countries where governments will confiscate radios. I mean, this recently happened in Zimbabwe. Robert Mugabe's government confiscated shortwave radios because of a number of stations that are broadcasting to Zimbabwe. We've seen the same kind of thing happen in other parts of the world. What about in your situation? Was there at any point you started getting reports that people were getting knocks at the door saying, you have a shortwave radio, what are you listening to? And if you're listening to the station, we'll take your radio away.
Yes, there is an element of that pressure. Already politicians and their clients, by whom I mean the headmen who are appointed and paid to keep an eye on the Longhouse communities. Many are speaking out, telling people they shouldn't listen to the radio, disapproving of the radio, saying that it's poisoning minds and telling untruths and so forth. So far, I think that's done us more harm, good than harm, actually, because it's created an interest.
Right, because usually when that kind of thing happens, people wonder, well, why don't they want us to listen? I have to listen to find out.
Exactly. I think Malaysia has managed to get away with not being such an oppressive society. You know, they've managed to get away with what they want, which is basically stripping Borneo of its natural resources without having to resort to the sorts of extreme violence that you would see in some countries like Zimbabwe. And therefore, you do have a gentler society. And I think there is resistance to actually going in and sort of snatching radios from people, snatching their possessions. But there is definitely a very strong undercurrent of disapproval. You know, it's a standoff. We've got a standoff at the moment, but I'm absolutely determined that we're going to push our right to be heard, and people should be allowed to listen and contribute to our programs. And I think if we stand up for that right, and show ourselves to be determined and brave, then the authority, it's a better way of handling the authorities in Malaysia, because, you know, they once they cross the barrier of locking people up and confiscating radios, you know, then really the truth will be out, won't it? The accusations that they're every bit as bad as Zimbabwe will have been proven. So they're trying to avoid doing that at the moment, and I'm just getting on with my job. I mean, what we remind our listeners is that in the recent elections in Malaysia, the ruling party lost. The majority of votes went to the opposition parties. So therefore, we're part of the opposition. We're part of the majority with Radio Free Sarawak. BN, the ruling coalition, are going to have to learn their place in Malaysia these days.
Now, as for the audience, do you also get a big response, not just from that area, but also from Malaysians who are not in the region that you're targeting?
Yes. Unintended consequences have been a very interesting part of this project. Obviously, I've been speaking, as I say, our broadcasts are mainly in Iban, which is the interior language, or the main interior language. Actually, there are about 43 different languages in Sarawak alone. But that's very much a deliberate gesture towards the native people. And it's not a language that people speak in West Malaysia. However, the very fact that we exist, the very fact that we're doing what we're doing, has created a great deal of interest, I think. And it's also enabled me to platform the issues and to remind people in West Malaysia just how despicable some of the actions of the government of Sarawak have been towards native people. And so we've been getting our message over to the West Malaysian audiences as well. And I think it played into the election result I just mentioned, where the opposition party, in fact, won nearly 10% more of the vote than the ruling party did in West Malaysia.
For yourself, was this something very personal that you wanted to do? I mean, how did you get interested in the issues that are important to this area?
Well, I was born in Sarawak and spent my very early years there and have the sort of memories that, you know, anyone who grew up somewhere would. But when I went to live the rest of my life in Europe, I guess I had thought and hoped that, independent Sarawak, Malaysia would manage, you know, without me, as it were, and certainly they have. But I got sucked back into involvement in Sarawak when, I've been watching, obviously, with heavy heart at what had been going on there in terms of deforestation, environmental destruction, and the more I looked into it, I realized also dreadful human rights issues. And I went back to visit and learned more and started asking, well, who's publicizing this? Who's criticizing it? Who's opposing what's going on? And who's exposing the evident corruption of the government that's been in power there for the last 50 years? And more and more the answer came back, well, nobody's doing anything. And eventually I came to the sort of conclusion that, you know, if I didn't speak out, then nobody much else was. And I felt I had a sort of duty, really, to do what I could.
Now, we know that, of course, that the Malaysian government is not too happy with the station. Has the Malaysian government contacted the British government and said, you have to stop these guys?
Well, I think they'd have got short shrift and quite a loud laugh in their ear if they had. we believe in freedom of speech here and in freedom of opinion. And obviously we believe that opposition parties and critics of governments should be allowed to have their say and be heard. So I don't think the Malaysians complaining that someone was breaking their incredibly draconian press laws would impress the British very much. And I don't think they would be seeking to silence me from here. So I don't think diplomatic channels would have been adopted by the Malaysians. I think we have given them a puzzle to deal with, actually. The reason why I'm doing what I'm doing, and the reason why no one's doing it in Sarawak, obviously, is that there are very, very harsh laws against media freedom in Malaysia. I mean, in fact, despite being quite a gentle society in many respects, Malaysia does have one of the most restrictive set of press laws in the world, and freedom of expression is very heavily curtailed. So, you know, it is very difficult for anyone to get away with doing what I do out of Malaysia. They would be banged up or told they were breaking licensing rules and so forth.
That's a little strange, because you're not using transmitters in the country. You're using transmitters outside the country, which Malaysian authorities have no jurisdiction over.
Well, that's been my answer, hasn't it? That's why I'm giving them a bit of a headache. Local Malaysians would be under pressure either by their nationality, the fact they live in Malaysia, they're subject to the laws of Malaysia, and they're in Malaysia. They're much more easily restricted by Malaysia's very repressive laws. However, with me, they've got a bit of a headache, because actually, what law am I breaking? The Home Minister, when sort of informed of my irritating activities, publicly came out and said that he would leave no stone unturned to find a law that I was breaking. Presumably, he's been turning stones over, and as of yet, he hasn't found a law that I'm breaking. In fact, they're the ones who've been breaking laws, because they've resorted now to trying to jam my broadcasts, and that breaks the international protocols to which they have signed up. So they're breaking the law at the moment. I'm not.
Now, yeah, let's get on to jamming for a moment, because you're not jammed all the time. You're jammed at certain, say, if I can put it this way, sensitive times in Malaysia, like elections.
I'm not sure about that. Every now and again, we have problems with our broadcasts. I think every now and again, they do just come in and shake us about a bit. But yes, it seems to be, you know, Malaysia's had the same government in power now for 50 years. It's the oldest supposedly elected regime in the world. And, you know, they've settled into a way of doing things, and they're a bit lazy in between, I think. And so they, you know, there's a flurry of activity around elections where they rush around knocking everybody off offline, not just me, but anybody, you know, who has an opposition newspaper or whatever. And jamming people. It's not just me that they've been jamming. And then things do tend to go quiet in between those election periods. It seems to be a cycle of doing things, but, you know, we carry on.
Now, the jamming thing, of course, is very interesting, because very few countries are capable of jamming. We know the North Koreans do it, the Vietnamese, the Cambodians, the Chinese, the Cubans. The Soviet Union was notorious during the Cold War era, but the Malaysians are not capable of jamming. They don't have the right facilities from it. Do you have a source, or you have an idea where the jamming is coming from?
They're not jamming in the way that one thinks of say China might jam. All they're doing is putting another more powerful program out on our wavelength, which of course is highly illegal to do. And anybody who's helping them do that, any professional transmission station or you know, professional in the business of organizing radio broadcasts, is breaking rules to do that. But that's what's been going on. And these rival broadcasts have come at us from different directions over the years. I mean, as I say, we've had different waves of jamming, and you know, we can detect them coming from different places, but that's how they're managing it. They're obviously commissioning someone who's prepared to break the law, who has found a transmission station that is prepared to break the law, who is then you know, broadcasting on our wave band. And you know, we've had all sorts of interesting sounds. We had American gospel music was played you know, across our program back in 2011, but in fact I don't think it had anything to do with the US, that particular jamming.
Now, the audience you're targeting, do they write to you? And what kind of things do they say?
Well, it's more exciting than that, actually. We decided, having established that there were definitely people out there, we decided, well, you know, we don't want to keep talking at them. The whole point of this is that we give the people in the interior a voice just as much as hearing us. So we decided that we would open a phone line, and we do this. We disguise ourselves as much as we can, but there is a phone line, a Malaysian phone line, that people can ring. And we started that up about 18 months ago now, and the response has just been terrific. We get, you know, a whole lot of phone calls every day from these very remote communities. I mean, what it's a mixture of, fascinatingly, is this rather sort of old and defunct technology of shortwave, which has been phased out for most radio broadcasts, with all the penetration that we now have of the hand phone. So even the most remote longhouses in Sarawak, you know, you'll have one or two people in those communities who have a mobile phone. And although they may not themselves be in range, usually they're not, you know, they live down by rivers and, you know, they can't get a signal in their longhouse areas. But what they'll do if they want to talk to us is they'll climb up a hill. You know, they'll walk for 3 or 4 hours to get to a place where they know they can get a signal. And then they'll sit up there until they've got hold of us. And done the interview about their particular problem. And it's wonderful that that's happening.
Now, you've said before that Malaysian government officials have talked about you. Have you been back to Malaysia, and can you go back? Or did you ever go back and they said, no, you can't enter the country?
Well, no, I back channels have long told me that I'm on blacklists, both in Malaysia and Sarawak. And in fact, I went back to Sarawak about in July of this year because there was a defamation suit against me from one of the people I'd written about in a critical fashion had decided to sue me in the Sarawak court. And so I went back to Sarawak to state my right, really, to appear to defend myself in the court. And of course, I never got through immigration. They threw me out, which confirmed, you know, what I knew, which is that I'm certainly banned from Sarawak. I've also been told that I'm similarly on the list to be arrested and deported were I to attempt to enter mainland Malaysia. And plenty of critics of the regime in mainland Malaysia have received that treatment. So I suspect that that's correct.
Now, let's talk about, you know, funding, if you can talk about that. Because you said at the beginning you started the station off yourself. Does funding come from people in these communities who maybe now live overseas who donate money to the station? Or do you get money from other sources?
I'm getting an increasing amount of money, actually, from that source, which is wonderful. You know, I'm getting some serious support now from some people from Sarawak who've heard about what we're doing, and that money I'm putting into a fund, and we're going to start a radio drive again. We've obviously distributed a lot of radios through the interior, but many communities are still saying they haven't got access to the program. So we'll keep that fundraising going. And there are other issues. There are other issues that sort of money goes to as well. For example, I've got one or two key research projects that I'm looking to develop over the next few months. But fortunately, you know, I rather started this on a wing and a prayer, and fortunately, one or two other key funders have come in to support me who have absolutely no connection whatsoever with Malaysia, but who are concerned about native rights and rainforest issues. So that's enabled us to pay those scary broadcast fees that we get.
That was my conversation with Claire Rucastle, the founder of Radio Free Sarawak. To find out what their broadcast times and frequencies are, just do a search in Google, Radio Free Sarawak. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Quite often we get requests from radio stations around the world asking to broadcast this show and other shows from PCJ Radio. Now, last month I was contacted by a gentleman who calls himself Chrissy Cochran. Well, that is his name, of course. He's the managing director of a station called The Global Voice based in London. It's a 24 internet radio station that started in, well, a number of years ago. And what they do is different from other internet radio stations. First, they program their schedule so certain shows get repeated to certain time zones around the world at primetime areas. That's the first thing. The second thing is they're 24/7. Not too many internet radio stations are. And they do a mixture of live programming and pre-recorded shows. Well, I said to him, if you're going to be running Media Network Plus, we have to do an interview about the Global Voice. And he said, on one condition, I can interview you for a program that I do on the Global Voice. And I said, sure, no problem. Why not? So let's now find out a little bit more from the Global Voice.
Voice is an internet radio station. Now, many internet radio stations, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners will know, have, say, three or four programs, and the rest of the time is music, usually automated. When we started the station about, well, it's nearly 4 years ago, decided that we would have all programming, and as it was a global station, that we would do roughly what the old BBC World Service used to do, and that is have target areas. So in other words, we'd repeat programs for different target areas where possible. And this was very useful when we had more languages than we do now, because we do have other languages. We had some Spanish programs, so we'd target it for Europe or target it for South America, etc. But we do have music. It's multi-format station. That's the simplest way to put it.
But one of the interesting things about the station is that it is for the visually impaired, because when you look at the website, it's a very, very simple website, which is needed.
Slight correction. It's not for the visually impaired. It's run by the visually impaired. It's for, the strapline says, helping the world's blind and sighted communities see eye to eye. So it is for both. And my attitude is that when you're behind a microphone, it doesn't matter whether you're blue, green, yellow spots, blind, sighted, or whatever. And it doesn't matter what the listener is either. But it is run primarily by visually impaired people. And we just made it nice and simple for everyone to find things. Not everyone is highly computer literate. Not everyone gets around a web browser easily. So we thought, let's just make it simple. Mind you, we do have it in 40 languages.
So what kind of programming do you have? Because you said that you have certain programs that are in different languages that target specific regions of the world. You also repeat programs to reach audiences in a prime time in a certain area. How do you fill up that airtime?
With repeated programs, we have about 25 in-house staff all over the world at the moment. They're in Sweden, Denmark, the US and Canada and the UK. We have had them in South America, in Australia, but we have about 25. We also in-source programs. We bring Harry Shearer's Le Show in. We bring Democracy Now! In each weekday from Pacifica Network, and one or two other programs. So we do have current affairs programs and that. And programs can be anything from half an hour to the longest we have is 3 hours.
You know, speaking from experience here, I know that starting a new station, internet or even like we are using shortwave satellite and FM relays is certainly not an easy task. And I remember when I was starting PCJ off in 2009, people were looking at me saying, Keith, didn't you take your medicine today?
Yeah, radio is dead. What are you doing starting it? You know, yeah, I agree. But what happened was that I got into radio through being a DJ for a station that was run by the American Council of the Blind, ACB Radio, which is still going today. And my contract, having done DJ work, I then knew their then current station manager who wanted to leave the station. He said, are you interested in the job? I said, what does it entail? So he told me, I said, yeah, why not? So I did it for a couple of years, which got me two trips to the States, which was very nice. Actually three. And when my contract ended, they decided they wanted an American as managing director because they hadn't had one. They'd had a guy called Jonathan Mosen who'd started the station. He was from New Zealand. It was Dave Williams and myself, both English, and they wanted an American. So I thought, what am I going to do? So I decided to start a station myself. And fortunately for me, and not for ACB Radio, quite a few of the staff members wanted to come with me. So I had a built-in staff to kick off with of about 10, 12 people, and away we went.
Now, you say that you just a moment ago that you have over 20 shows. You didn't start with 20 shows, did you?
We started with a full program schedule.
A full program schedule?
Well, yes, in that, you know, there were repeats, obviously, as well. But we run 24-7, and we have 24-7 off programming. So they may be repeats, but they're not not usually repeated in the same day sort of thing. So if you wanted to sit and listen for 24 hours, you wouldn't hear the same program again.
And what kind of programming do you have?
We have the usual music programs, be they pop. I, for one thing, do a country show. We have soul shows and what have you. Our flagship talk program is one on a Sunday evening at 18 hours UTC called The Attitude Test, where we have...
Sounds like a game show.
yeah. It tests your attitude. We talk on any subject, and the more attitude people have, the better we like it. We like it sort of edgy where possible. But there are five of us from the staff on the show using Skype, and we use Skype for call-ins as well. So the show doesn't flag. If nobody calls in, there are enough of us to keep the conversation going, but a lot of people do call in. That's an hour-long show. We have other talk programs, Media Network Plus included. We take programs from the United Nations as well. We have programs specifically for the blind and visually impaired, two major ones run by a guy who's sadly deceased, and we're rerunning all his programs, a guy called Mark Marvel. We do Eyes on Employment and The Sound of Sight. And the usual music programs, but we have a wide range from a program on operetta to a program called Everything But the Kitchen Sink, which is very, very eclectic indeed.
You know what's interesting, because you've been in radio for a while, same with me, and today, the way you can start a station, producing content, having people from all around the world is so much easier. I mean, I still remember a time when if we were doing an interview and I wanted the same kind of quality, I would have to send somebody to your location in the UK with a microphone and tape recorder, record your voice, send the tape over to me by courier, and then spend about an hour or so editing it together to make sure it made some kind of sense. Whereas today, everything can be done so much easier and so much simpler. You don't have to buy satellite time, and you can have 10 guests all together at one time.
Well, that's true. And I've noticed even the major stations like the BBC are beginning to use things like Skype, A, presumably because they're cheaper, and B, because they're just very quick to do. But yes, it is great to be able to do that, but it doesn't alter the fact that you need to know a bit about broadcasting. You can't just sit down and play music and expect to maintain listeners.
You're listening to The Voice.
Now, of course, radio has changed a lot. I mean, we're using software these days. And is there software out there for the visually impaired? Because if I look at, say, some of the software that we're using, you really need sight to be able to use it.
There is software. For example, I would you believe I use, and I'm sure most people who listen to programs on the internet are well aware of this program called Winamp, God bless it. And there are various means of using that for streaming. Now, other people use a program called Station Playlist, which now has some very, very good scripts which have been written to make it easier for visually impaired people to use it with a screen reader. And there's no problem at all.
So they can use a screen reader on this software and know how to do things. It's that simple?
Yeah, it's that simple. It really is. And that includes editing. I mean, we can use things like SoundForge or Sonar, various other editors that sighted people use. There are some that we do have difficulty with. But if from the point of view of ordinary two-track editing, SoundForge works extremely well.
I remember a couple of years ago meeting a listener of mine and also a listener of yours by the name of Dave Marthouse. And I was visiting him in the United States, and I was sitting in this room, and he had his, his mobile phone, and it was almost like his mobile phone was telling him where to press and what to do and everything. And I just found that absolutely extraordinary because, you know, in the days when people were using tape, you know, you couldn't do that. And if you were editing, you'd probably cut your fingers off, you know? I mean, but with the way technology has become, it's just become so much more accessible. And it sounds as if with your station and the people that you have working there that now this one community that maybe couldn't work in radio before unless they were working as a producer or a presenter can do so many other things.
Well, yes. I mean, the Global Voice does have an extremely good in-house production team, which I would rate against any production team anywhere. And it's just because it's been a hobby of people. They've really got to grips with the editing. They know how to do promos. They know how to do their own beds. I mean, you can get them from common sources, of course, but most people do their own for the Global Voices point of view. And, you know, we do our own promos, liners, and things for the shows.
Now, the Global Voice, is this the only station of its internet station of its kind around, or do you have any type of competition out there?
We do have competition, yes, indeed. I mean, I'm an oddball. I don't mind mentioning other stations because the blind community is small enough, and I am a great believer in cooperation. The only way we will get our voice heard in the radio industry is by cooperation. There are one or two who like to stick avidly to themselves, but I am not a great believer in that. For example, there is a guy on another station called Mint FM coming out of Israel who is doing a 48-hour DJ Marathon in support of the Macmillan Cancer Trust this weekend. And we've cooperated with them. We'll be taking part of their show. We've been running their promo. And I'm quite happy to do that. I think we need more of this.
Well, cooperation between radio stations is something that is rarely seen. There should be more of it. And I think it benefits everybody.
We're such a small community that we're never going to get our voice heard as single little stations. We never are. There's just no way. However, if we do combine and a little bit of a force for good in the world kind of thing, then we may stand a chance.
Now, a lot of radio stations out there use all types of social media to get the work out about what they're doing. What about yourselves? Or is it just by word of mouth because you said the community is so small?
Yeah, that's the blind community in general. But remember, we are not just for the blind community, as I said earlier on. So we use Facebook. We have a Facebook page, and we also use Twitter. We have mailing lists, and there are lists for people interested in, for example, internet radio. There are a couple of those, so we advertise our programs there. So we get the word out.
Is your station also available on services like TuneIn and others where they can use a phone app to listen?
Yes, TuneIn Radio, we are certainly available on. We are about to be available on iTunes. We're just sorting that out now. That will take a few weeks, typical iTunes. It will take a while to go through the bureaucracy. But yes, we are on TuneIn Radio, OOTunes, and most of the Android versions of them as well, obviously.
Now let's talk about the way you distribute the programs. You said it is through online. You have different programs that are repeated for certain targets. This doesn't sound like something that you can do cheaply. I mean, where does the money come from?
It comes from me, basically. we have a server in France which has plenty of disk space. We found that France, the service that particular ISP provided was exactly suited our needs. So we're able to play repeat programs straight from the server, which means there doesn't have to be anyone watching it all the time. We have a playout system which, when a program ends, will play promos and liners and stuff until either it's time for the next program to start or someone comes on live. It sort of goes live, repeat, promos. So that's the order. Live has preference. Mm-hmm. But the station, the thing is absolutely ruthless. As I tell the various members of my staff, I say, well, don't you dare run over the top of the hour because it'll kick you off. That's when the next program is due to start, and that's when it will start. So it is ruthless.
Now, let me ask you, I mean, in the UK, Ofcom offers, you know, broadcast license for special radio stations for a short time. Have you ever looked at doing something like that?
It's just too expensive, quite frankly. And for the short time, it's really not worth doing. I don't think. I had thought about it, and we also thought about going on the Sky Digital platform. But again, it's just too expensive, really. I wish it wasn't, mm-hmm. and I wish it was easier for small stations to do that sort of thing, to get well known. But it isn't. I don't have that sort of money. I have enough, you know, I have the sort of money to keep the station going quite happily, but not that sort of money, I'm afraid.
Which is actually a bit of a shame. I know that in the US, they just changed the regulation now, so stations can get what they call a Part 15 license, which means actually it's they don't really technically need a license as long as they broadcast under a certain amount of power. But I heard that in the UK, there's a lot of bureaucracy when it comes to Ofcom.
Oh, the bureaucracy is ridiculous. The one thing they have allowed us to do at long last is use FM transmitters in the house. We don't need a license for that. At one time, it was strictly verboten here. You just could not do it. Now they have graciously allowed that. I think it's up to 500 milliwatts or something,
mm-hmm.
and a whip antenna.
Oh, okay. But I suppose like maybe somebody across the street can hear you, right?
Oh, yes. Yes, they can and do. But as for the short-term license, I mean, you know, they're usually for a couple of weeks or a month at the very outside. And you're looking at a couple of £1,000 and they want to install their transmitter for you to do it, and et cetera, et cetera. You can't use your own. And, of course, naturally, you pay for that.
So you can't bring your own transmitter. It has to be one provided by Ofcom.
It has to be, yes, absolutely.
That's I can see where that becomes very expensive indeed. What about commercial advertising? Do you have any on the station?
No, we don't. We do allow sponsorship, which mm-hmm. is slightly different, as people in the States will know. You cannot do a direct call to action sort of thing. Visit such and such a website. You can't do that, but you could say this program is sponsored by. And we do have a rate card for that.
Is that because of regulations, or is that the station's regulations?
It's the station's regulations, quite frankly. I suspect that if we went blatantly commercial, we'd be under more scrutiny, and you never know what things we might be inadvertently going against, if you know what I mean.
Right. Now, if somebody's listening right now, Chrissy, and they want more information, where can they go?
Oh, quite simple. To The Global Voice, all one word, .info. No www required. So it's http://, The Global Voice, all one word, theglobalvoice.info. And there you will find links to the various lists we have for listeners, etc. We have a program gallery where most programs are kept up there for a week, except the talk programs, which tend to stay up for the year. For example, the Attitude Test, we've got back to January of this year. And the Voices program, we also have back. But the music programs and things like that stay up there for the week and are replaced by the next one.
You're listening to The Global Voice.
And that was my conversation with Chrissy Cochran, the managing director of The Global Voice, based in London. Well, now let's take a few moments to talk about PCJ. On October the 13th, 2013, PCJ Radio International will be conducting a two-hour transmission to Southeast Asia and East Asia in DRM, that's Digital Radio Mondiale. The frequency for that broadcast is 15645 kHz. Now, the lineup will be the following. At 10:30 UTC, news, followed by Switzerland in Sound. At 11 hours UTC, the weekly version of Media Network Plus. Then at 11:30 UTC, news. Followed after the news will be a documentary from Jonathan Marks, and then we sign off at 12:30 UTC. Now, we're going to be using 85 kilowatts targeting the region, so it should be interesting to see if we get reception reports from listeners outside the target area who have DRM receivers. To talk a little bit more about this and other things as well, we're now joined by our frequency manager. That's right, PCJ's own frequency manager, Victor Gunatelica. Now, Victor, before we talk about DRM and other things, one question that's been coming in from a number of listeners is, what is the history of the Trincomalee site that we're going to be using for this DRM test?
Well, it was built in 1982, and first test transmissions began in 1982.
So this is what you would call a relatively new station compared to some of the other ones that are around the world that are in operation then.
Oh, yes. You know, for these very well, ruggedly and built reliability and all that, you know, they are not like cheap transistor radios that hit the market. They are really million-dollar devices, and they last years and years. And some of the transmitters, even from the BBC that we are hearing, would very well be more than 25, 30 years old, but they are so reliable.
Okay, now let's talk about DRM for the for a moment. Now, what kind of DRM equipment does Trinco have?
Well, we are using mono. We are unable to do stereo at the moment. So we're running 85 kilowatts. We can manage 85 kilowatts, and that's quite a reasonable or very decent power level, because most stations have been using about less than 100 kilowatts anyway, or some even trying to save on the energy, which is one of the prime reasons they are thinking of DRM, things like 50 to 60 kilowatts. So I think the DRM transmission that we are trying to make from Trincomalee, quite a reasonable and quite a standard one.
You know, one of the big criticisms that I've heard from a number of people concerning DRM is that sometimes stations use too little power. In that, you know, they think, oh yeah, you can use less power because the signal's going out digitally. But, you know, it's like a mobile phone. If you don't have any signal, you don't get anything at all. And there's so much noise and static on the bands that you actually need some decent power to get something that is audible.
Exactly, Keith, because unlike analog shortwave, even if the signal is not excellent, even at what we call, our listeners are happy with, the SINPO code, even if a signal is S3, signal strength 3, you'll still hear it and you'll be able to get the program content. May not be excellent, but DRM is a different story. Either you get it very well or you don't get it at all, because it drops below a threshold level and it doesn't fade in and out, or it keeps dropping in and out. So for DRM, you really need to give a decent strong signal that the listener can decode from his radio. Otherwise, what happens is it's just noise on an analog radio, and on your digital radio, it just drops off into nothingness. So you need decent power. So there has to be a compromise. You just can't say, okay, we are going to use 25 kilowatts and we are saving power and it's digitally encoded and all that. So no, you have to think of the listener as well. He's not running massive antennas. We're talking about a simple antenna or maybe a telescopic whip antenna and things like that. So you're trying to replace analog, which can be picked up even on a small portable radio, may not be the excellent quality that DRM can deliver. But in the first place, the listener has to be able to get it and have audio.
How important is it, Victor, when choosing a frequency to broadcast on DRM?
Well, yes, these are two things that are uppermost in my mind. You know, DRM, analog cannot interfere with DRM as such. So, in short, DRM can just walk over anybody and just come in. And, you know, on a DRM receiver, the analog signal will not give you any problems. But the analog listener will be completely swamped by the DRM signal. And it could be so annoying, completely losing signal. So our policy at PCJ and my own policy has been, I'll never like to use on the traditional analog band. So when selecting a frequency for DRM, I believe that we should at least go out of the old traditional analog band. For instance, if we are using 15 megahertz, as we are going to do on the 13th of October, we'll definitely not use anything below 15,500 or 15,450.
So, Victor, what you're saying then is, let's say there's an analog station out there and somebody wants to jam it, they can put a DRM signal out there, jam the audio from the analog signal, but if somebody has a DRM receiver, be able to pick up the DRM audio with no problem? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly, exactly. DRM, analog wouldn't interfere with DRM, but DRM would completely knock out the AM signal. I'll give you, if giving another example for you, VOA from Thailand was using 250 kilowatts to beam to South Asia. And the Deutsche Welle in the good old days of DRM, they were broadcasting to Russia, Eastern Europe, with just about 50 kilowatts. And that signal, which was completely beam away from South Asia, although VOA was beaming to South Asia, just single hop, the VOA was completely swamped until Deutsche Welle went off. So it's like a hash jammer.
Here's a question that somebody emailed me this past week, on Monday, in fact. They said, does DRM propagate the same way as traditional analog shortwave?
Well, Keith, yes. It's a shortwave signal, only the transmission is a much broader signal, and it propagates just like the traditional shortwave signal, analog transmitted signal, and there wouldn't be much of a difference between the propagation characteristics. So only thing is, as I said before, if the DRM signal gets through, there's no fading, you get some lovely, steady audio.
So let me ask you then, if international broadcasters said to you, Victor, listen, right now we're only running 50 kilowatts in DRM here, and another broadcaster says, oh, we're running 20 here, but, you know, we're having problem with signal stability. You would recommend to them, increase your power or choose a better frequency?
Well, ideally, the best frequency propagationally is paramount, whether you're on analog or digital. And the other thing is, since DRM is more susceptible to signal loss, rather audio loss dropping out, I would ask them not to be too stingy on power. Now, I have done this test with All India Radio on air. They broadcast to Sri Lanka, and they were using about 50 kilowatts, and the dropout rate was quite considerable. And the engineer on air, he was increasing the power. And when we reached 65 kilowatts, as opposed to the regular 50, things started becoming very reliable. So a few kilowatts here and there can make a big difference.
Victor Gunatelica, thank you very much for joining us. And if you want more information of what the programming will be for that DRM broadcast on October the 13th, just check out our website, www.pcjmedia.com. Victor, thanks again.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Victor Gunatelica, PCJ Radio's frequency manager. And we were talking about DRM and the special DRM transmission that we will have targeting listeners in Southeast Asia and East Asia on October 13th, 2013. And the frequency for that is 15645 kilohertz. You can find out all the details at our website, www.pcjmedia.com. Now, hopefully, propagation will be good. And speaking of propagation, we now look at what we can expect for propagation-wise over the next 7 days. Here's our propagation, yes, Keith, get it right. Propagation editor, Dan Hensley.
Here's propagation for the week from September 28th to October 4th, 2013. A 10.7 centimeter flux of 100 from September 28th to September 30th, then from October 1st to October 4th, a 10.7 centimeter flux of 95. September 28th will see an A index of 8, an A index of 10 on September 29th, back down to 8 on September 30th. October 1st, an A index spiking at 10 once more, down to 8 once more on September 2nd, with an A index of 5 on October 3rd and 4th. A KP index of 3 all week long from September 28th to October 2nd. October 3rd and 4th, a KP index of 2. This week brings us some new sunspots with 1846, 49, 50, 51, and 52 present. None of the sunspots are actively flaring, and that means nice, quiet solar conditions, resulting in nicely quiet radio conditions. September 21st was the first day of fall, so that means we should be seeing some of the famous fall propagation conditions that everyone loves so much. Back to you, Keith.
All right, thanks, Dan. Hopefully next week I won't screw up your intro like that again. Well, not next week because this is the monthly edition, but at least on the 30-minute edition. Anyway, that's all we have time for. If you wish to contact us to let us know what reception is like in your area or have any comments or suggestions for us, our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. We're going to end today with a group called Manu Chao, and the song is called Clandestino. And if you listen carefully, there's some radio broadcasts that are mixed into the recording. It's absolutely fantastic. So on behalf of the whole team, this is Keith Parent wishing you well, saying 73 and 88 to the ladies.
Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino por no llevar papel. Pa una ciudad del norte yo me fui a trabajar. Mi vida la dejé entre Ceuta y Gibraltar. Soy una raya en el mar, fantasma en la ciudad. Mi vida va prohibida, dice la autoridad. Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino por no llevar papel. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino, yo soy el quiebraley. Mano negra clandestina, peruano clandestino, africano clandestino, marihuana ilegal. Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino por no llevar papel. Argelino clandestino, nigeriano clandestino, boliviano clandestino, mano negra ilegal.
Je voulais fabriquer des métiers, des métiers sérieux, des métiers de toutes sortes. Je voulais que c'est mon nom, je suis la guerre, car avant vous, la Chine, c'est le jour de Mauritania. Oui, j'ai l'air en bas chez le Gaisir, radiateur, ouais.